We're going to consider Yukawa interactions in the standard model. The reason that we need Yukawa interactions is because, of course, that our standard model gauge symmetry is chiral. Therefore, it forbids any mass terms. So the fact that all of the fermions, or I should say all of them except for the neutrinos in the standard model have mass, means that we need to generate masses somehow. And we can do them through Yukawa interactions. So a mass term of the form psi bar psi is forbidden by the gauge symmetry. And we want to generate terms of this type through Yukawa interactions. Before we write down Yukawa interactions, we need to recall a little bit about SU2 group theory. The name of the game is writing down terms in the Lagrangian that are invariant under the symmetries of the gauge group. And the gauge group that we have to worry about is SU2 left. So let's think how we can write down expressions that are invariant under SU2 transformations. So suppose we have two vectors. So let's say we have two component vectors. That are fundamentals under SU2. And I'll call them eta and c. So each one of these things is just a two-component object that gets rotated by a 2x2 matrix, which is your SU2 matrix. I want to be able to write down an expression in terms of eta and c that's invariant under SU2 transformations. And there's two ways. To write SU2 invariant contractions. Of eta and c. The first one is you just take eta dagger. And then contract that into c. And there's one more way as well. You can take the following. You can write eta transpose times the epsilon tensor. So this is a 2x2 antisymmetric matrix. And then contract that with c. So here, epsilon is the antisymmetric tensor written as follows. So it's the antisymmetric tensor acting on SE2 indices. And let me just remind you, in general, SUN you have two invariant tensors. One is just the identity, which I can write as Kronecker delta ij. And so if I have the identity matrix and I transform both of the indices as follows, u dagger times the identity u. OK, the identity will just commute through. I just have u dagger u, which is the identity. And so I just get the identity back. And so this contraction, or I should say this invariant tensor, corresponds to the first type of contraction that I did. But then the other type of contraction is I can write down the antisymmetric tensor. So for general SUN, I need to write down n indices. So I would have I, j, k, dot, 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 up to n indices. And this would transform as epsilon ijk dot 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 goes to ui I prime uj j prime dot 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 epsilon I prime j prime dot dot dot. And then this is just equal to the determinant of U times epsilon ij dot dot dot. And since the determinant of U for SUn is equal to 1, this is just epsilon ij dot dot dot. So I just get the antisymmetric tensor back. So the case of SU2 is a little bit special because both of these two invariant tensors both have two indices, and in general I can use both of them to contract together two objects. So I can use this to write down my Yukawa interactions. And first, let me just omit the generation indices. So I could have a term like this, where I have h dagger, d bar right, q left. Or I could have a term like this, where I would have d bar right q left transpose epsilon acting on h. And I've sort of hidden all of the indices here, but hopefully it's clear what's going on. The Lorentzian, or I should say the spinner indices are contracted between the two spinners. The color indices are contracted between the two quark fields here. The SU2 indices are contracted between the two SU2 doublets. So in that case, it's the Higgs doublet and contracted into the quark left-handed doublet. So that case is using this invariant tensor. In the bottom case, I have, again, the left-handed quark field is contracted into the Higgs doublet using the epsilon tensor. And so that would correspond to this case here. So there's other ones I can write down as well. So there's also u bar right q left transpose epsilon h. And then there's h dagger. U bar right, Q left. And then I also have H dagger, E bar right, left-handed lepton. And I have E bar right, left-handed lepton transpose epsilon times H. Okay. Maybe also I should make clear that when I write transpose here, it's only acting on the SU2 indices. Okay. So for every combination of the three different fields I want to contract together, there's just two invariant tensors I can use. So there's two different cases for each one. So it turns out that the ones I wrote at the top are the only ones that are allowed. So these are valid Yukawa interactions. And these in the bottom row are invalid. Does anyone know why? Anyone want to guess? OK. No one wants to guess, and I'm not going to tell you.
Is it to do with the chirality?
Nope. Chirality is fine. So I have the same chirality of the fields in both cases. So that part is OK.
Does it have to do with the fact that the charges of the right and the scalar field has to sum the same charge of of the left field or something like that? Like what we said when we were talking about the Yutkawa term, that we needed the charges to have a certain relation?
Yeah, it's, you're kind of on the right track. So the reason is that only the ones at the top satisfy all of the gauge symmetries of the standard model. So I told you that the color indices are contracted into each other. Okay, so that the SU3 part is fine. The SU2 parts are contracted into each other using these invariant tensors, so that part is fine. And so the only leftover one to worry about is hypercharge. So it turns out that the top row is consistent with hypercharge symmetry, but the U1 hypercharge, but the bottom row is not. So we can't violate the symmetries. All right, so you can only use the top ones. All right. So so we can only use those first three interactions. But we can generalize the interactions because, in principle, any two generations of fermions can be coupled together. So I should write that any generations I and J can be coupled via the Yukawa interaction. So let me write down a fully general expression for the Yukawa interactions. So I'll just do the three terms generalized. So I have a coupling constant, which I'll call capital U, and it'll involve U right, Q left, transpose epsilon H. And now it can couple any two generations together. So I should write an I here and a J here. And so now my coupling constant is actually a matrix. It has indices I and J depending on generation. And then I do the same thing for the other interactions. So I'll have Y D I J. And then that is, H dagger, D right I, Q left J. And then I have Y E I J, which is H dagger, E right I, left-handed lepton J, plus Hermitian conjugate. OK. Now, if I expand this in a unitary gauge, so I expand my Higgs fields. So I'll write the following. One over square root of two, zero V plus H. And then just plug it in here. I get minus V U I J, U right I. So for this first expression, I just get the two component, only the two component is non-zero here, and then because it's contracted with the epsilon tensor, only the one component of the quark doublet will contribute. The one component is U, so I have U left J, and then I have V plus H over square root of 2. Let me factor out the V over square root 2 out front. So I'll have V over square root 2, and then times 1 plus H over V. Now for the next term, I'll have YD IJ. So here, the two component is non-zero, but it's contracted with the identity matrix. And so I'll get the two components of the quark doublet. So it'll be D left. So I'll have V over square root 2, D right I, D left J, times 1 plus H over V. And the next term will be very similar. OK. So, I forgot one thing. So this looks, it's starting to look like mass terms. If I just get rid of the V, the H over V part, starting to look like mass terms where I couple together the fields, the left and right-handed fields. But the problem so far is that these expressions are all non-diagonal in general. And so what I need to do is just diagonalize all of these matrices to put the mass term in diagonal form. So what we want to do is just diagonalize. And in general, these matrices are just arbitrary 3x3 matrices. They don't necessarily need to be Hermitian or real. So I need to be quite general in how I diagonalize them. So it turns out that you need to diagonalize using what's called a biunitary transformation. So let me just write down what that means, and then we're going to show that it's true. So let's say we have a square matrix M. We can diagonalize it as follows. We take M and we transform it by acting on the left and the right with a unitary transformation, a different unitary transformation on the left and the right. So I'll act with it with a U dagger on the left and another unitary matrix V on the right. And this will bring it into a diagonal form, which I'll call MD. And the diagonal entries are going to be real and positive. And so that's what we would need for our masses. So let's prove that this is true. I forgot to mention, okay, U and V are unitary matrices. So here's the proof. So we start out with a square matrix. Then I can write down M dagger. This matrix is Hermitian with real and positive eigenvalues. Because it's Hermitian, I can diagonalize it using a unitary transformation, not a biunitary transformation. So if I write down U dagger, M dagger, U, this is equal to a diagonal matrix where the eigenvalues are along the diagonal. So I can write this as MD squared. Diagonal matrix with real positive eigenvalues. Now, let me rewrite this line as follows. So I'll write this as U dagger, M dagger, U. And then let me multiply on the left by something called MD inverse. And so this would be MD on the right-hand side. So MD, all I'm going to do is just take the square root, the positive square root of all of the entries of this matrix and define that to be MD. And then that's easy to invert. And I'll take that matrix MD inverse and multiply that on both sides on the right. So now I'm going to define this thing as another matrix, which I'll call V. And so that essentially completes the proof. All we need to do is show that this matrix V is unitary. here. So if I write VV dagger, that's MD inverse U dagger M. And then I have M dagger U MD inverse. So this is V and this is V dagger. Dagger will just reverse the ordering and then complex conjugate transpose everything. So this is MD inverse. Then I have U dagger, MM dagger, U, and then MD inverse. This whole thing here is just MD squared. And so this whole thing is just equal to the identity matrix. So V is unitary. And so we've proved our assertion that we can diagonalize our arbitrary square matrix using a biunitary transformation. There's one small caveat with our proof, which is that we assumed we could define this quantity MD inverse. If one of those eigenvalues is zero, then you can't define the inverse of that matrix. What's the inverse of zero? But you can generalize the proof even in the case of zero mass. But of course, we don't really have to worry about that because none of the masses of our fermions in the standard model are zero, except for the neutrinos, but we're not writing down the mass terms for the neutrinos anyway. So we don't really need to worry about that case. All right. So let's go back to our Yukawa interaction that I wrote there on the upper right boards. And I'm going to write it in matrix form. So I'll have U bar right M U U left times 1 plus H over V minus D right bar M D D left 1 plus H over V minus E right, M E, E left, 1 plus H over V plus permission conjugate. And I've defined all of these matrices. For example, M U I J would just be the Yukawa coupling times V over square root 2. And I've suppressed the generation indices. You're supposed to think of this as a vector, a three-component vector in generation space. So for example, if I write U left, this is a vector U left 1, U left 2, U left 3. So it's a vector over generations. Okay, so now we want to diagonalize these arbitrary matrices M using our biunitary transformation. So let's again just consider the up quark terms. So I can diagonalize this as follows. I'll define one matrix, one unitary matrix as U sub U right. And then I'll have M U. Then I'll have another unitary matrix on the other side. U left. And so this is our biunitary transformation. It diagonalizes our mass matrix. And we'll get a diagonal matrix, which I'll write just as little m. And so this will just be a diagonal matrix where the eigenvalues are mu1, mu2, mu 3. And these are the mass eigenstates for the uptype quarks. So I could write this as mu, mc, mt. Sure, it's a consequence of hypercharge. So let me write down the hypercharge of all of these different fields. So y, the hypercharge for the Higgs doublets was 1/2. The hypercharge for the left-handed quark doublet was 1/6. And the hypercharge for the right-handed down field was minus 1/3. So if I check hypercharge conservation, what I should have is minus 1/3, so plus 1/3. And then here I have the left-handed quark field, I get a 6. And here I have the Higgs doublet, so plus 1/2. If I add all of this up, I just get plus 1. It's not equal to 0, meaning that it doesn't conserve hypercharge. This one, the only difference is that instead of having plus 1/2, I have h dagger, means I have minus 1/2. And so if I add all of those up, I would get 0. Okay, so we've diagonalized our mass matrix using these matrices U, U left, and U, U right, which are unitary, two unitary matrices. So I can define a new set of fermion fields in the mass basis, which I'll call U prime. So U left and right prime would be fields in the mass eigenstate basis. And I'm going to define them as follows. So my original fields will just be the transformations of the mass eigenstate fields like this. Or I could have written it as my new fields in the mass eigenstate basis are just related to U dagger times the old fields. All right. So now I can express my Yukawa term as follows. I have U bar right, mu U left. And this is equal to my transform field. So I'll have U right prime. U right dagger, and then I have my mass matrix. And then I'll have U left prime. And so that was exactly what I needed to diagonalize this matrix M. Yes?
What basis were the fields originally written in? Like, what were the eigenstates of?
Yeah, so that's typically known as the gauge eigenstate basis. And the reason for that, what kind of ruins a little bit of the punchline that I'm getting to, is that what we'll see is that in the original basis, the gauge interactions are all diagonal, meaning that generation 1 is only coupled to generation 1, et cetera. In this new basis, that will no longer be true for all of the gauge interactions. So we're going to get to that part. Now, here's what I'm doing. And so now I have a diagonalized matrix. And so it's U bar right prime times this matrix little m, which is diagonal, and then U left prime. So now I've diagonalized the mass terms with in my new basis. So I could expand this out. I would have m u times u right bar prime u left plus mc c bar right c left prime, and then mt t bar right prime e left prime, like this. Okay, so this is just expanding everything out explicitly. So my mass terms are now all real and diagonal. And I can do the same trick, of course, for all of the different fields. So let me define d left and right would be u d left right acting on the mass basis. I have e left right is u e left right acting on the mass basis. So over here, these are the original basis, and this is the mass eigenstate basis. So again, they're just related by unitary transformation. Now, I also wanted to find a rotation of the neutrino fields as well. There's no neutrino mass matrix. There's no Yukawa term for the neutrino fields that I've written down. So I'm actually free to use any matrix I like, any unitary matrix, to rotate those fields. And it turns out to be useful is if I just rotate them using the same unitary matrix that I used for the left-handed leptons. And you'll see why I make that choice soon. So I'm going to define the left-handed neutrino field in the original basis to be a unitary transformation, which just corresponds to the same one that I used for the left-handed charged leptons. Acting on a new basis, which will be sort of the mass eigenstate basis, quote unquote. It's not the mass eigenstate basis for the neutrino fields. It's just the corresponding basis for the charged leptons. Okay. So now that I've done this, now that I've done this, all of my Yukawa terms are simplified. So in this basis, all of my Yukawa interactions can be written as follows. I have minus sum over all of the fermion psi, m psi, psi bar psi, 1 plus h over v. I kind of skipped this step, but the terms that I wrote down plus the Hermitian conjugates all pair together to give us terms that look like psi bar psi for all the different fermions. So for example, the terms that I wrote down were u right bar u left. When you add together the Hermitian conjugate, you'll get u bar left, u right. And so those all pair together to just give you terms of the form u bar u, or in general, psi bar psi. OK. So now psi is going to be equal to all of my different fermion fields, ui, ei, or ei, in this mass basis. Okay. Now you can see again what happens to the Higgs interactions. Still, I'm left over with this extra term, 1 plus h over v. Again, the fact that we're generating all of these masses through Yukawa interactions through the Higgs mechanism is very predictive. It tells me that all of the couplings between the fermions and the Higgs field are just proportional to the masses of those fermions. All right, so now that we've diagonalized the mass terms, what we want to do is check what happens to the weak interactions. And first, let's consider the neutral current. So let's go back and write down what the neutral current is. I have the electron charge, Q, so for an arbitrary fermion, it will psi, it'll have an arbitrary charge Q psi. And then I have an interaction, which is like A slash psi bar, A slash psi. So this is the photon interaction. And then I have the Z interaction, G over cosine theta W, psi bar, Z slash, T3 left, E left, minus Q psi, sine squared theta W, acting on psi. Okay. So let's consider the following, and it works similar for all of the different fermions. We'll consider psi to be the uptype quark fields of index I. And I guess this should be a prime. Okay, I don't need that right here just yet. So one important point is that all of the any generation index that I write down always will have the same electric charge, and it also has the same T3 left. Okay, so those quantum numbers are independent of generation. So let me write down the neutral current for the uptype quark field. I'll have E times QU, and I have U bar left I, A slash U left I, plus U bar right I, A slash U right I. That's the photon interaction. Then I have the Z interaction. U bar left I, Z slash, and the left-handed part goes like T3 left minus QU sine squared theta W, U left I, and then I have minus U right I Z slash QU sine squared theta W, U right I. Okay, so I've broken it up into two different chiralities because both chiralities will rotate under different unitary matrices. Still, what I've written down is the original basis. Now, what we want to do is just transform to the mass eigenstate basis. So, for example, I'll have a term like this, U bar left I, gamma mu, U left I. When I transform, I'll just have to introduce the different matrices. So I'll have U bar left J, then I'll have U left dagger, J I, gamma mu, then I'll have U left I K, and then I'll have U left K, and then these should be the primed fields like this. Okay, so I'm just rotating the fields, writing out all of the indices explicitly. The gamma matrix only acts on the space of spinners, And so these unitary transformations only act on the generation indices. They commute through the gamma matrix. And you can see I just have U dagger U. It's the same U entering in both cases, which will just give me the identity. And so I'll just have U bar left prime I gamma mu U left I prime. So for any interaction in the neutral current, it always looks similar. You know, I might have a right here instead of a left. But at the end of the day, the transformation always works in the following way. If I started out with a diagonal interaction in the original basis, the neutral current is always diagonal in any other basis, including the mass eigenstate basis. So the neutral current is diagonal in the mass eigenstate basis. And it's diagonal for both the photon and the Z. So nothing I wrote down is really specific to the considering the U fields. It's the same for all of the fermions. The neutral current is always going to be diagonal for any of the fermions. And so the conclusion is that neutral current interactions do not change the fermion flavor or generation, or you could say fermion type. So if you have any type of fermion going in, it has to be the same one that's going out of that vertex. Now let's consider what happens to the charge current interactions. So I had G over square root of 2. I have U left bar I, W slash plus D left I, plus nu left bar I, W plus slash E left I, plus Hermitian conjugate. Now when I transform to the mass eigenstate basis, you get the following. G over square root 2, I'll have U bar left J prime. And then I have a matrix U, U left dagger, J I, W slash plus U, D left I K, and then D left K prime. Okay, that was the quark part. Then I have the lepton parts, nu bar left prime, J prime. Now remember, I'm transforming my neutrino fields using the charged lepton matrix, unitary matrix. So I should write down E left dagger JI. And I have W plus slash U E left IK, and then E left K prime, and then plus Hermitian conjugate. Bless you. Now, for the lepton terms, you can see why it was useful to use the left-handed charged lepton matrix to rotate my neutrino fields. That's because I just get the same unitary matrix, U dagger U, and so that will give me just the identity matrix. And so the neutrino, the charge current interactions for the leptons is still going to be diagonal in this in the mass eigenstate basis. On the other hand, for the quarks, it's no longer the case because I have two different matrices here. They don't need to be the same. At the end of the day, my charge-current interaction for quarks is no longer going to be diagonal. So, let's define a matrix V, IJ, which will be, or let's make just define a matrix V, which is U, U left dagger times U, D left. So V is this product of the two matrices entering into here, and the fact that V need not be diagonal is what's going to give us the fact that the interaction with the W may change flavors to different types. So I have this matrix V, and if you expand it in components, it's a 3x3 matrix, and the different entries will connect the different mass eigenstate fields together. And so I could label the components based on which different fields it connects. And so let me just write this out explicitly. So I have VUD, VUS, VUB, VCD, VCS, VCB, VTD, VTS, VTB. This matrix here is known as the Kabibo Kobayashi. Moskawa matrix. Also known as the CKM matrix. And experimentally, it's not equal to the identity matrix. So all of these parameters can be measured experimentally. So what I get for my charge-current interactions is as follows. So I have G over the square root of 2. I have U bar left prime I, B I J, W plus slash D left J prime. And then I plus the same corresponding terms for the leptons. Plus summation conjugate. So the charge kind of interactions will couple together quarks of different flavors. I can write down the Feynman rules. So if I have a W plus going in, then I'll have a U, I, and a D, J like this. This should be a prime. And the Feynman rule would be minus IG over square root 2 times VIJ gamma mu P left. For the leptons, if I have a left-handed lepton charged lepton J going in and a neutrino I coming out, the Feynman rule would be I G over square root 2, gamma mu P left, but then times the Kronecker delta. Only the same generation can be coupled together. All right, the next thing we'll talk about is the effective field theory for the weak interaction. Um, Now, the weak interaction was known, of course, much earlier than we knew about W and Z bosons. And the reason is that, well, the W is the only term, is the only interaction that can change fermions from one type to another. So we have observed, for example, muons very long ago, and the fact that those muons will decay tells us something about the weak interaction. They're very long-lived, but they do decay. So for processes which have relevant energies much below the mass of the W and the Z, we don't need to use the full dynamics of the standard model with W and Z as degrees of freedom. We can do what's called integrating them out to write down an effective vertex that describes those interactions at lower energy scales. So that's what we'll do. We'll integrate out the W and the Z. And we'll express the weak interactions. Through non-renormalizable operators. And this prescription is valid provided the relevant energy scales in the problem are much, much smaller than the mass of the W or the mass of the Z. So the example that we're consider is muon decay. And let me write down the Feynman diagram. We have a muon going in, and say we have a momentum P. It will get converted into a muon neutrino, momentum P prime. We have a W going this way with momentum K. And then we'll have a charged lepton and electron, and then an electron antineutrino. And I'll call these momentum Q and Q prime. So what I'm going to do is just write down the matrix element for this process in the full standard model. Then I'm going to assume this limit here. And then I'm going to show that this corresponds to a non-renormalizable interaction that I could write down. So I'll write down the matrix element. So we have an electron spinner, and we have IG over the square root of 2, gamma mu, P left. Then I have the antiparticle spinner for the electron neutrino. So that was this part of the diagram. Now I have the propagator for the W. So I have to write down I minus I over K squared minus MW squared. And then I have eta mu nu minus K mu K nu over MW squared. And then I have the fermion line for the muon part. And so that will be U bar for the outgoing muon neutrino minus IG over square root of 2 gamma nu P left and then U for the muon. So the first thing that I want to do is consider the K mu K nu parts of the propagator. I'm going to show that that term is very suppressed. Actually, first, let me note this momentum K. It's going to be depending on the momentum P and P prime here, or Q and Q prime. We have a muon decaying. The muon has around 100 MeV of energy. And so K will also be of order 100 MeV or so, all the different components of K. So if I compute K squared, it will be something roughly of order muon mass squared. The muon is much, much lighter than the mass of the W. And so the only thing I'm trying to say is that K squared would be much, much lighter than the mass of the W squared. So first of all, I can neglect this part here, compared to the W part. Now let's consider a k mu k nu term. Well, actually, now that I told you all of the different components of k are much, much smaller than mw, right away you could say that that term also should be suppressed. There's another argument you can make as well to be a little bit more explicit. For example, if I take, because I have k mu and k nu here, you can see that a factor of k will contract into the corresponding gammas appearing in the fermion part of the matrix elements. And so I'll have terms as follows. For example, I'll have u bar e k slash p left v nu e. And k is just equal to q plus q prime. And so I could write this as nu a u bar e q slash plus q slash prime p left v nu e. Now I can just anti-commute these different matrices with this here. So first of all, q was the momentum of the electron. And so where q slash multiplies u bar, I just get the mass of the electron. For the q prime, that was the momentum of the neutrino. And so I can just anti-commute this, or I should say, I can, if I move it over here, I convert this from p left to p right. And then when I have q slash prime acting on the neutrino spinner, then I get zero, since it's assumed to be massless. And so at the end of the day, I just have me times u bar e p left v nu e, like this. Similarly, for the muon part, I have u bar nu mu k slash p left u mu. And this is gives me m mu times u bar nu mu p right u mu. So you can see that I'll have, I can take k mu and k nu, I get powers of me and m mu. And so this term here will be suppressed. By me mu over mw squared. So this is a very small number. I don't need to consider it any further. This is around 10 to the minus 8. OK. So with all of those simplifications and throwing out everything that has an explicit dependence on k, I can write the matrix element as follows. It is I g squared over 8 mw squared. I have u bar e gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5. So I've written my projection operator as 1 minus gamma 5 over 2 and factored out a factor of 2. Then I have v nu e. And I have u bar nu mu, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5. And then I have u mu. So this is my matrix element. And now, in order to match it onto an effective non-renormalizable operator in an effective theory, I just need to ask what type of interaction can give rise to this matrix element. So that interaction is as follows. So let me focus first on this part here. So I would need to have an electron field, E bar, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, and then a neutrino electron neutrino field. And then I need nu mu bar, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, mu on field, plus summation conjugate. And now I need to put in the coefficient. It's just everything out in front, except for the factor of I. And so that will be this factor of g squared over 8 mw squared. But for historical convention, it's denoted as a coefficient gf, Fermi's constant, divided by the square root of 2. So gf is equal to Fermi's constant. And gf over the square root of 2 is just equal to g squared over 8 mw squared. So I just have one more minute of things to say, so let me just try to finish this up. So as long as you're at an energy scale much less than the mass of the W, you can always describe all of the weak interactions using an effective interaction. And so the weak interaction connects not just muons and electrons, but every type of fermion in the standard model. So I can write down an effective theory for all of the charge-current interactions. It will be G Fermi over the square root of 2. And then I'll have to sum over all the different flavors. E bar I gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, nu I. Then nu bar J gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, E J, plus summation conjugate. These are the leptonic charge-current interactions. I also have interactions connecting the quarks and leptons together. Those would look like G Fermi over square root of 2, sum over I, J, and K. I have a V, I, J. For the hadronic part, the part involving quarks, I have U bar I gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, dj, and then I have e, k, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, nu k. This is known, a plus summation conjugate. This is known as the semi-leptonic charge-current interaction. And then I have terms that are purely hadronic, terms that are purely involving the different quark fields. So I need to sum over four different generation indices, V, I, J, V, K, L, star. And I have U bar I, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, D, J. And then I have D bar L, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, U, K, plus summation conjugate. And this is the hadronic part. I've omitted the primes. These should be the mass eigenstate fields. But from now on, I'm just going to leave off the primes. So you can see that there's tons of interactions. The weak interaction, the weak charge-current interaction, gives rise to tons of different couplings between all of these different pairs of leptons and quarks. In general, if I just wrote down an arbitrary set of non-renormalizable operators coupling four fermions together, I could write down any magnitude of the coupling out in front that I wanted. For every pair, it could be independent. I can also write down any type of Dirac structure I want in between the different fermion fields. But the fact that everything is coming from a gauge interaction means that all of these different expressions are much more predictive. First of all, the fact that it's coming through a gauge interaction tells me that the coefficient in front of all of the different interactions has to be the same, up to the factors of the CKM matrix. So that's a factor of everything is coming from a gauge interaction with the same gauge coupling little g and the same gauge boson mass mw. It also tells me why I have to have the same Dirac structure inside. Everything is coming from SE2 left. And so everything has to involve a gamma mu, meaning it's a vector boson, and a 1 minus gamma 5, meaning it only couples to the left-handed fermions. So this is one of the triumphs of this SE2 left cross U1 gauge theory. It predicts a universal, what's called a V minus A cross V minus A structure. What V minus A means is I have vector gamma mu minus axial vector gamma mu gamma 5. And so that's what it means for both of these different terms. OK. So let's quit here, and then we'll continue tomorrow. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer questions.